Galileo also invented the thermometer, at least this seems most probable. His pupil, Torricelli, invented the barometer. Guericke, 1602-86, invented the air pump. Clocks, though not new, were greatly improved in the 17th century, largely by the work of Galileo. Owing to these inventions, scientific observation became immensely more exact and more extensive than it had been at any former time. Next, there was important work in other sciences than astronomy and dynamics. Gilbert, 1540-1603, published his great book on the magnet in 1600. Harvey, 1578-1657, discovered the circulation of the blood and published his discovery in 1628. Leeuwenhoek, 1632-1723, discovered spermatozoa, though another man, Stefan Harm, had discovered them apparently a few months earlier. Leeuwenhoek also discovered protozoa, or unicellular organisms, and even bacteria. Robert Boyle, 1627-91, was, as children were taught when I was young, the father of chemistry and son of the Earl of Cork. He is now chiefly remembered on account of Boyle's law, that in a given quantity of gas at a given temperature, pressure is inversely proportional to volume. I have hitherto said nothing of the advances in pure mathematics, but these were very great indeed, and were indispensable to much of the work in the physical sciences. Napier published his invention of logarithms in 1614. Coordinate geometry resulted from the work of several 17th century mathematicians, among whom the greatest contribution was made by Descartes. The differential and integral calculus was invented independently by Newton and Leibniz. It is the instrument for almost all higher mathematics. These are only the most outstanding achievements in pure mathematics. There were innumerable others of great importance. The consequence of the scientific work we have been considering was that the outlook of educated men was completely transformed. At the beginning of the century, Sir Thomas Browne took part in trials for witchcraft. At the end, such a thing would have been impossible. In Shakespeare's time, comets were still portents. After the publication of Newton's Principia in 1687, it was known that he and Halley had calculated the orbits of certain comets and that they were as obedient as the planets to the law of gravitation. The reign of law had established its hold on men's imaginations, making such things as magic and sorcery incredible. In 1700, the mental outlook of educated men was completely modern. In 1600, except among a very few, it was still largely medieval. In the remainder of this chapter, I shall try to state briefly the philosophical beliefs which appear to follow from 17th century science and some of the respects in which modern science differs from that of Newton. The first thing to note is the removal of almost all traces of animism from the laws of physics. The Greeks, though they did not say so explicitly, evidently considered the power of movement a sign of life. To common sense observation, it seems that animals move themselves, while dead matter only moves when impelled by an external force. The soul of an animal, in Aristotle, has various functions, and one of them is to move the animal's body. The sun and planets in Greek thinking are apt to be gods, or at least regulated and moved by gods. Anaxagoras thought otherwise, but was impious. Democritus thought otherwise, but was neglected, except by the Epicureans, in favour of Plato and Aristotle. Aristotle's 47 or 55 unmoved movers are divine spirits, and are the ultimate source of all the motion in the universe. Left to itself, any inanimate body would soon become motionless. Thus, the operation of soul on matter has to be continuous if motion is not to cease. All this was changed by the first law of motion. Lifeless matter, once set moving, will continue to move forever unless stopped by some external cause. Moreover, the external causes of change of motion turned out to be themselves material, whenever they could be definitely ascertained. The solar system, at any rate, was kept going by its own momentum and its own laws. No outside interference was needed. There might still seem to be need of God to set the mechanism working. The planets, according to Newton, were originally hurled by the hand of God. But when he had done this, and decreed the law of gravitation, everything went on by itself without further need of divine intervention. When Laplace suggested that the same forces which are now operative might have caused the planets to grow out of the sun, God's share in the course of nature was pushed still further back.
He might remain as creator, but even that was doubtful, since it was not clear that the world had a beginning in time. Although most of the men of science were models of piety, the outlook suggested by their work was disturbing to orthodoxy, and the theologians were quite justified in feeling uneasy. Another thing that resulted from science was a profound change in the conception of man's place in the universe. In the medieval world, the earth was the center of the heavens, and everything had a purpose concerned with man. In the Newtonian world, the earth was a minor planet of a not specially distinguished star. Astronomical distances were so vast that the earth, in comparison, was a mere pinpoint. It seemed unlikely that this immense apparatus was all designed for the good of certain small creatures on this pinpoint. Moreover, purpose, which had since Aristotle formed an intimate part of the conception of science, was now thrust out of scientific procedure. Anyone might still believe that the heavens exist to declare the glory of God, but no one could let this belief intervene in an astronomical calculation.
The world might have a purpose, but purposes could no longer enter into scientific explanations.
The Copernican theory should have been humbling to human pride, but in fact the contrary effect was produced, for the triumphs of science revived human pride. The dying ancient world had been obsessed with a sense of sin and had bequeathed this as an oppression to the Middle Ages. To be humble before God was both right and prudent, for God would punish pride. Pestilences, floods, earthquakes, Turks, Tartars, and comets perplexed the gloomy centuries, and it was felt that only greater and greater humility would avert these real or threatened calamities. But it became impossible to remain humble when men were achieving such triumphs. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, "Let Newton be," and all was light. And as for damnation, surely the creator of so vast a universe had something better to think about than sending men to hell for minute theological errors. Judas Iscariot might be damned, but not Newton, though he were an Arian. There were, of course, many other reasons for self-satisfaction. The Tartars had been confined to Asia, and the Turks were ceasing to be a menace. Comets had been humbled by Halley, and as for earthquakes, though they were still formidable, they were so interesting that men of science could hardly regret them. Western Europeans were growing rapidly richer and were becoming lords of all the world. They had conquered North and South America, they were powerful in Africa and India, respected in China, and feared in Japan. When to all this were added the triumphs of science, it is no wonder that the men of the 17th century felt themselves to be fine fellows, not the miserable sinners that they still proclaimed themselves on Sundays. There are some respects in which the concepts of modern theoretical physics differ from those of the Newtonian system. To begin with, the conception of force, which is prominent in the 17th century, has been found to be superfluous. Force, in Newton, is the cause of change of motion, whether in magnitude or direction. The notion of cause is regarded as important, and force is conceived imaginatively as the sort of thing that we experience when we push or pull. For this reason, it was considered an objection to gravitation that it acted at a distance, and Newton himself conceded that there must be some medium by which it was transmitted. Gradually, it was found that all the equations could be written down without bringing in forces. What was observable was a certain relation between acceleration and configuration. To say that this relation was brought about by the intermediacy of force was to add nothing to our knowledge. Observation shows that planets have at all times an acceleration towards the sun, which varies inversely as the square of their distance from it.
To say that this is due to the force of gravitation is merely verbal, like saying that opium makes people sleep because it has a dormitive virtue.
The modern physicist, therefore, merely states formulae which determine accelerations and avoids the word force altogether. Force was the faint ghost of the vitalist view as to the causes of motions, and gradually the ghost has been exorcised. Until the coming of quantum mechanics, nothing happened to modify in any degree what is the essential purport of the first two laws of motion, namely this, that the laws of dynamics are to be stated in terms of accelerations. In this respect, Copernicus and Kepler are still to be classed with the ancients. They sought laws stating the shapes of the orbits of the heavenly bodies. Newton made it clear that laws stated in this form could never be more than approximate. The planets do not move in exact ellipses because of the perturbations caused by the attractions of other planets. Nor is the orbit of a planet ever exactly repeated for the same reason. But the law of gravitation, which deals with accelerations, was very simple and was thought to be quite exact until 200 years after Newton's time. When it was amended by Einstein, it still remained a law dealing with accelerations. It is true that the conservation of energy is a law dealing with velocities, not accelerations, but in calculations which use this law, it is still accelerations that have to be employed. As for the changes introduced by quantum mechanics, they are very profound, but still to some degree a matter of controversy and uncertainty. There is one change from the Newtonian philosophy which must be mentioned now, and that is the abandonment of absolute space and time. The reader will remember a mention of this question in connection with Democritus. Newton believed in a space composed of points, and a time composed of instants, which had an existence independent of the bodies and events that occupied them. As regards space, he had an empirical argument to support his view, namely, that physical phenomena enable us to distinguish absolute rotation. If the water in a bucket is rotated, it climbs up the sides and is depressed in the center. But if the bucket is rotated while the water is not, there is no such effect. Since his day, the experiment of Foucault's pendulum has been devised, giving what has been considered a demonstration of the Earth's rotation. Even on the most modern views, the question of absolute rotation presents difficulties. If all motion is relative, the difference between the hypothesis that the Earth rotates and the hypothesis that the heavens revolve is purely verbal. It is no more than the difference between John is the father of James and James is the son of John. But if the heavens revolve, the stars move faster than light, which is considered impossible. It cannot be said that the modern answers to this difficulty are completely satisfying, but they are sufficiently satisfying to cause almost all physicists to accept the view that motion and space are purely relative. This, combined with the amalgamation of space and time into space-time, has considerably altered our view of the universe from that which resulted from the work of Galileo and Newton. But of this, as of quantum theory, I will say no more at this time. Chapter 7. Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626, although his philosophy is in many ways unsatisfactory, has permanent importance as the founder of modern inductive method and the pioneer in the attempt at logical systemization of scientific procedure. He was a son of Sir Nicholas Bacon, Lord Keeper of the Great Seal, and his aunt was the wife of Sir William Cecil, afterwards Lord Burleigh. He thus grew up in the atmosphere of state affairs. He entered Parliament at the age of 23 and became adviser to Essex. Nonetheless, when Essex fell from favour, he helped in his prosecution. For this he has been severely blamed. Lytton Strachey, for example, in his Elizabeth and Essex, represents Bacon as a monster of treachery and ingratitude. This is quite unjust. He worked with Essex while Essex was loyal, but abandoned him when continued loyalty to him would have been treasonable. In this there was nothing that even the most rigid moralist of the age could condemn. In spite of his abandonment of Essex, he was never completely in favour during the lifetime of Queen Elizabeth. With James's accession, however, his prospects improved. In 1617 he acquired his father's office of Keeper of the Great Seal, and in 1618 he became Lord Chancellor. But after he had held this great position for only 2 years, he was prosecuted for accepting bribes from litigants. He admitted the truth of accusation, pleading only that presence never influenced his decision. As to that, anyone may form his own opinion, since there can be no evidence as to the decisions that Bacon would have come to in other circumstances. He was condemned to a fine of £40,000, to imprisonment in the Tower during the King's pleasure, to perpetual banishment from court, and inability to hold office. This sentence was only very partially executed. He was not forced to pay the fine, and he was kept in the Tower for only 4 days. But he was compelled to abandon public life and to spend the remainder of his days in writing important books. The ethics of the legal profession in those days were somewhat lax. Almost every judge accepted presents, usually from both sides. Nowadays we think it atrocious for a judge to take bribes, but even more atrocious, after taking them, to decide against the givers of them. In those days, presents were a matter of course, and a judge showed his virtue by not being influenced by them. Bacon was condemned as an incident in a party squabble, not because he was exceptionally guilty. He was not a man of outstanding moral eminence, like his forerunner Sir Thomas More, but he was also not exceptionally wicked. Morally, he was an average man, no better and no worse than the bulk of his contemporaries. After 5 years, spent in retirement, he died of a chill, caught while experimenting on refrigeration by stuffing a chicken full of snow. Bacon's most important book, The Advancement of Learning, is in many ways remarkably modern. He is commonly regarded as the originator of the saying, knowledge is power, and though he may have had predecessors who said the same thing, he said it with new emphasis. The whole basis of his philosophy was practical. To give mankind mastery over the forces of nature by means of scientific discoveries and inventions. He held that philosophy should be kept separate from theology, not intimately blended with it, as in scholasticism. He accepted orthodox religion. He was not the man to quarrel with the government on such a matter. But while he thought that reason could show the existence of God, he regarded everything else in theology as known only by revelation. Indeed, he held that the triumph of faith is greatest when, to the unaided reason, a dogma appears most absurd. Philosophy, however, should depend only upon reason. He was thus an advocate of the doctrine of double truth, that of reason and that of revelation. This doctrine had been preached by certain Averroists in the 13th century, but had been condemned by the Church. The triumph of faith was, for the Orthodox, a dangerous device. Bayle, in the late 17th century, made ironical use of it, setting forth at great length all that reason could say against some orthodox belief, and then concluding, "So much the greater is the triumph of faith in nevertheless believing." How far Bacon's orthodoxy was sincere, it is impossible to know. Bacon was the first of the long line of scientifically minded philosophers who have emphasized the importance of induction as opposed to deduction. Like most of his successors, he tried to find some better kind of induction than what is called induction by simple enumeration. Induction by simple enumeration may be illustrated by a parable. There was once upon a time a census officer who had to record the names of all householders in a certain Welsh village. The first that he questioned was called William Williams. So were the second, third, fourth. At last he said to himself, "This is tedious. Evidently, they are all called William Williams. I shall put them down so and take a holiday." But he was wrong. There was just one whose name was John Jones. This shows that we may go astray if we trust too implicitly in induction by simple enumeration. Bacon believed that he had a method by which induction could be made something better than this. He wished, for example, to discover the nature of heat, which he supposed, rightly, to consist of rapid, irregular motions of the small parts of bodies. His method was to make lists of hot bodies, lists of cold bodies, and lists of bodies of varying degrees of heat. He hoped that these lists would show some characteristic always present in hot bodies and absent in cold bodies, and present in varying degrees in bodies of different degrees of heat. By this method, he expected to arrive at general laws, having, in the first instance, the lowest degree of generality. From a number of such laws, he hoped to reach laws of the second degree of generality, and so on. A suggested law should be tested by being applied in new circumstances. If it worked in these circumstances, it was to that extent confirmed. Some instances are specially valuable because they enable us to decide between two theories. Each possible so far as previous observations are concerned, such instances are called prerogative instances. Bacon not only despised the syllogism, but undervalued mathematics, presumably as insufficiently experimental. He was virulently hostile to Aristotle, but thought very highly of Democritus. Although he did not deny that the course of nature exemplifies a divine purpose, he objected to any admixture of teleological explanation in the actual investigation of phenomena. Everything, he held, should be explained as following necessarily from efficient causes. He valued his method as showing how to arrange the observational data upon which science must be based. We ought, he says, to be neither like spiders, which spin things out of their own insides, nor like ants, which merely collect, but like bees, which both collect and arrange. This is somewhat unfair to the ants, but it illustrates Bacon's meaning. One of the most famous parts of Bacon's philosophy is his enumeration of what he calls idols, by which he means bad habits of mind that cause people to fall into error. Of these, he enumerates five kinds. Idols of the tribe are those that are inherent in human nature. He mentions in particular the habit of expecting more order in natural phenomena than is actually to be found. Idols of the cave are personal prejudices, characteristic of the particular investigator. Idols of the marketplace are those that have to do with the tyranny of words and the difficulty of escaping from their influence over our minds. Idols of the theater are those that have to do with received systems of thought. Of these, naturally, Aristotle and the Scholastics afforded him the most noteworthy instances. Lastly, there are idols of the schools, which consist in thinking that some blind rule, such as the syllogism, can take the place of judgment in investigation. Although science was what interested Bacon, and although his general outlook was scientific, he missed most of what was being done in science in his day. He rejected the Copernican theory, which was excusable so far as Copernicus himself was concerned, since he did not advance any very solid arguments. But Bacon ought to have been convinced by Kepler, whose new astronomy appeared in 1609. Bacon appears not to have known the work of Vesalius, the pioneer of modern anatomy, or of Gilbert, whose work on magnetism brilliantly illustrated inductive method. Still more surprising, he seemed unconscious of the work of Harvey, although Harvey was his medical attendant. It is true that Harvey did not publish his discovery of the circulation of the blood until after Bacon's death, but one would have supposed that Bacon would have been aware of his researches. Harvey had no very high opinion of him, saying, "He writes philosophy like a Lord Chancellor." No doubt Bacon could have done better if he had been less concerned with worldly success. Bacon's inductive method is faulty through insufficient emphasis on hypothesis. He hoped that mere orderly arrangement of data would make the right hypothesis obvious, but this is seldom the case. As a rule, the framing of hypotheses is the most difficult part of scientific work, and the part where great ability is indispensable. So far, no method has been found which would make it possible to invent hypotheses by rule. Usually, some hypothesis is a necessary preliminary to the collection of facts, since the selection of facts demands some way of determining relevance. Without something of this kind, the mere multiplicity of facts is baffling. The part played by deduction in science is greater than Bacon supposed. Often, when a hypothesis has to be tested, there is a long deductive journey from the hypothesis to some consequence that can be tested by observation. Usually, the deduction is mathematical, and in this respect, Bacon underestimated the importance of mathematics in scientific investigation. The problem of induction by simple enumeration remains unsolved to this day. Bacon was quite right in rejecting simple enumeration where the details of scientific investigation are concerned. For, in dealing with details, we may assume general laws on the basis of which, so long as they are taken as valid, more or less cogent methods can be built up. John Stuart Mill framed four canons of inductive method, which can be usefully employed so long as the law of causality is assumed. But this law itself, he had to confess, is to be accepted solely on the basis of induction by simple enumeration. The thing that is achieved by the theoretical organization of science is the collection of all subordinate inductions into a few that are very comprehensive, perhaps only one. Such comprehensive inductions are confirmed by so many instances that it is thought legitimate to accept, as regards them, an induction by simple enumeration. This situation is profoundly unsatisfactory, but neither Bacon nor any of his successors have found a way out of it. Chapter 8. Hobbes's Leviathan. Hobbes, 1588 to 1679, is a philosopher whom it is difficult to classify. He was an empiricist, like Locke, Berkeley, and Hume, but unlike them, he was an admirer of mathematical method, not only in pure mathematics, but in its applications. His general outlook was inspired by Galileo rather than Bacon. From Descartes to Kant, continental philosophy derived much of its conception of the nature of human knowledge from mathematics, but it regarded mathematics as known independently of experience. It was thus led, like Platonism, to minimize the part played by perception and overemphasize the part played by pure thought. English empiricism, on the other hand, was little influenced by mathematics and tended to have a wrong conception of scientific method. Hobbes had neither of these defects. It is not until our own day that we find any other philosophers who were empiricists and yet laid due stress on mathematics. In this respect, Hobbes's merit is great. He has, however, grave defects, which make it impossible to place him quite in the first rank. He is impatient of subtleties, and too much inclined to cut the Gordian knot. His solutions of problems are logical, but are attained by omitting awkward facts. He is vigorous, but crude. He wields the battle axe better than the rapier. Nevertheless, his theory of the state deserves to be carefully considered, the more so as it is more modern than any previous theory, even that of Machiavelli. Hobbes's father was a vicar, who was ill-tempered and uneducated. He lost his job by quarrelling with a neighbouring vicar at the church door. After this, Hobbes was brought up by an uncle. He acquired a good knowledge of the classics and translated the Medea of Euripides into Latin iambics at the age of 14. In later life, he boasted justifiably that though he abstained from quoting classical poets and orators, this was not from lack of familiarity with their works. At 15, he went to Oxford, where they taught him scholastic logic and the philosophy of Aristotle. These were his bugbears in later life, and he maintained that he had profited little by his years at the university. Indeed, universities in general are constantly criticized in his writings. In the year 1610, when he was 22 years old, he became tutor to Lord Hardwicke, afterwards 2nd Earl of Devonshire, with whom he made the grand tour. It was at this time that he began to know the works of Galileo and Kepler, which profoundly influenced him. His pupil became his patron and remained so until he died in 1628. Through him, Hobbes met Ben Jonson and Bacon and Lord Herbert of Cherbury and many other important men. After the death of the Earl of Devonshire, who left a young son, Hobbes lived for a time in Paris, where he began the study of Euclid. Then he became tutor to his former pupil's son. With him he travelled to Italy, where he visited Galileo in 1636. In 1637, he came back to England. The political opinions expressed in the Leviathan, which were royalist in the extreme, had been held by Hobbes for a long time. When the Parliament of 1628 drew up the Petition of Right, he published a translation of Thucydides, with the expressed intention of showing the evils of democracy. When the Long Parliament met in 1640, and Laud and Strafford were sent to the Tower, Hobbes was terrified and fled to France. His book, De Cive, written in 1641, though not published till 1647, sets forth essentially the same theory as that of the Leviathan. It was not the actual occurrence of the Civil War that caused his opinions, but the prospect of it. Naturally, however, his convictions were strengthened when his fears were realized. In Paris, he was welcomed by many of the leading mathematicians and men of science. He was one of those who saw Descartes' meditations before they were published and wrote objections to them, which were printed by Descartes with his replies. He also soon had a large company of English royalist refugees with whom to associate. For a time, from 1646 to 1648, he taught mathematics to the future Charles II. When, however, in 1651 he published The Leviathan, it pleased no one. Its rationalism offended most of the refugees, and its bitter attacks on the Catholic Church offended the French government. Hobbes therefore fled secretly to London, where he made submission to Cromwell and abstained from all political activity. He was not idle, however, either at this time or at any other during his long life. He had a controversy with Bishop Bramhall on free will. He was himself a rigid determinist. Overestimating his own capacities as a geometer, he imagined that he had discovered how to square the circle. On this subject, he very foolishly embarked on a controversy with Wallace, the professor of geometry at Oxford, Naturally, the professor succeeded in making him look silly. At the Restoration, Hobbes was taken up by the less earnest of the king's friends and by the king himself, who not only had Hobbes's portrait on his walls, but awarded him a pension of £100 a year, which, however, his majesty forgot to pay. The Lord Chancellor, Clarendon, was shocked by the favour shown to a man suspected of atheism, and so was Parliament. After the plague and the Great Fire, when people's superstitious fears were aroused, the House of Commons appointed a committee to inquire into atheistical writings, specially mentioning those of Hobbes. From this time onwards, he could not obtain leave in England to print anything on controversial subjects. Even his history of the Long Parliament, which he called Behemoth, though it set forth the most orthodox doctrine, had to be printed abroad, 1668. The collected edition of his works in 1688 appeared in Amsterdam. In his old age, his reputation abroad was much greater than in England. To occupy his leisure, he wrote at 84 an autobiography in Latin verse, and published at 87 a translation of Homer. I cannot discover that he wrote any large books after the age of 87. We will now consider the doctrines of the Leviathan, upon which the fame of Hobbes mainly rests. He proclaims at the very beginning of the book his thoroughgoing materialism. Life, he says, is nothing but a motion of the limbs, and therefore automata have an artificial life. The Commonwealth, which he calls Leviathan, is a creation of art, and is in fact an artificial man. This is intended as more than an analogy, and is worked out in some detail. The sovereignty is an artificial soul. The pacts and covenants by which Leviathan is first created take the place of God's fiat when he said, "Let us make man." The first part deals with man as an individual and with such general philosophy as Hobbes deems necessary. Sensations are caused by the pressure of objects. Colours, sounds, etc. are not in the objects. The qualities in objects that correspond to our sensations are motions. The first law of motion is stated and is immediately applied to psychology. Imagination is a decaying sense, both being motions. Imagination, when asleep, is dreaming. The religions of the Gentiles came of not distinguishing dreams from waking life. The rash reader may apply the same argument to the Christian religion, but Hobbes is much too cautious to do so himself. Footnote. Elsewhere, he says, that the heathen gods were created by human fear, but that our God is the first mover. End of footnote. Belief that dreams are prophetic is a delusion, so is the belief in witchcraft and in ghosts. The succession of our thoughts is not arbitrary, but governed by laws, sometimes those of association, sometimes those depending upon a purpose in our thinking. This is important as an application of determinism to psychology. Hobbes, as might be expected, is an out-and-out nominalist. There is, he says, nothing universal but names, and without words we could not conceive any general ideas. Without language there would be no truth or falsehood, for true and false are attributes of speech. He considers geometry the one genuine science so far created. Reasoning is of the nature of reckoning and should start from definitions. But it is necessary to avoid self-contradictory notions in definitions, which is not usually done in philosophy. Incorporeal substance, for instance, is nonsense. When it is objected that God is an incorporeal substance, Hobbes has two answers. First, that God is not an object of philosophy. Second, that many philosophers have thought God corporeal. All error in general propositions, he says, comes from absurdity, that is, self-contradiction. He gives as examples of absurdity the idea of free will and of cheese having the accidents of bread. We know that, according to the Catholic faith, the accidents of bread can inhere in a substance that is not bread. In this passage, Hobbes shows an old-fashioned rationalism. Kepler had arrived at a general proposition, planets go round the sun in ellipses, but other views, such as those of Ptolemy, are not logically absurd. Hobbes has not appreciated the use of induction for arriving at general laws, in spite of his admiration for Kepler and Galileo. As against Plato, Hobbes holds that reason is not innate, but is developed by industry. He comes next to a consideration of the passions. Endeavour may be defined as a small beginning of motion. If towards something, it is desire, and if away from something, it is aversion. Love is the same as desire, and hate is the same as aversion. We call a thing good when it is an object of desire, and bad when it is an object of aversion. It will be observed that these definitions give no objectivity to good and bad. If men differ in their desires, there is no theoretical method of adjusting their differences. There are definitions of various passions, mostly based on a competitive view of life. For instance, laughter is sudden glory. Fear of invisible power, if publicly allowed, is religion. If not allowed, superstition. Thus, the decision as to what is religion and what superstition rests with the legislator. Felicity involves continual progress. It consists in prospering, not in having prospered. There is no such thing as a static happiness, excepting, of course, the joys of heaven, which surpass our comprehension. Will is nothing but the last appetite or aversion remaining in deliberation. That is to say, will is not something different from desire and aversion, but merely the strongest in a case of conflict. This is connected, obviously, with Hobbes's denial of free will. Unlike most defenders of despotic government, Hobbes holds that all men are naturally equal. In a state of nature, before there is any government, every man desires to preserve his own liberty, but to acquire dominion over others. Both these desires are dictated by the impulse to self-preservation. From their conflict arises a war of all against all, which makes life nasty, brutish, and short. In a state of nature, there is no property, no justice or injustice. There is only war, and force and fraud are, in war, the two cardinal virtues. The second part tells how men escape from these evils by combining into communities, each subject to a central authority. This is represented as happening by means of a social contract. It is supposed that a number of people come together and agree to choose a sovereign or a sovereign body, which shall exercise authority over them and put an end to the universal war. I do not think this covenant, as Hobbes usually calls it, is thought of as a definite historical event. It is certainly irrelevant to the argument to think of it as such. It is an explanatory myth used to explain why men submit, and should submit, to the limitations on personal freedom entailed in submission to authority. The purpose of the restraint men put upon themselves, says Hobbes, is self-preservation from the universal war resulting from our love of liberty for ourselves and of dominion over others. Hobbes considers the question why men cannot cooperate like ants and bees. Bees in the same hive, he says, do not compete. They have no desire for honor, and they do not use reason to criticize the government. Their agreement is natural, but that of men can only be artificial by covenant. The covenant must confer power on one man or one assembly, since otherwise it cannot be enforced. Covenants without the sword are but words. President Wilson unfortunately forgot this. The covenant is not, as afterwards in Locke and Rousseau, between the citizens and the ruling power. It is a covenant made by the citizens with each other to obey such ruling power as the majority shall choose. When they have chosen, their political power is at an end. The minority is as much bound as the majority, since the covenant was to obey the government chosen by the majority. When the government has been chosen, the citizens lose all rights except such as the government may find it expedient to grant. There is no right of rebellion because the ruler is not bound by any contract, whereas the subjects are. A multitude so united is called a commonwealth. This Leviathan is a mortal god. Hobbes prefers monarchy, but all his abstract arguments are equally applicable to all forms of government in which there is one supreme authority, not limited by the legal rights of other bodies. He could tolerate Parliament alone, but not a system in which governmental power is shared between King and Parliament. This is the exact antithesis to the views of Locke and Montesquieu. The English Civil War occurred, says Hobbes, because power was divided between King, Lords, and Commons. The supreme power, whether a man or an assembly, is called the sovereign. The powers of the sovereign in Hobbes's system are unlimited. He has the right of censorship over all expression of opinion. It is assumed that his main interest is the preservation of internal peace, and that therefore he will not use the power of censorship to suppress truth, for a doctrine repugnant to peace cannot be true, a singularly pragmatist view. The laws of property are to be entirely subject to the sovereign, for in a state of nature there is no property, and therefore property is created by government, which may control its creation as it pleases. It is admitted that the sovereign may be despotic, but even the worst despotism is better than anarchy. Moreover, in many points the interests of the sovereign are identical with those of his subjects. He is richer if they are richer, safer if they are law-abiding, and so on. Rebellion is wrong, both because it usually fails, and because if it succeeds, it sets a bad example and teaches others to rebel. The Aristotelian distinction between tyranny and monarchy is rejected. A tyranny, according to Hobbes, is merely a monarchy that the speaker happens to dislike. Various reasons are given for preferring government by a monarch to government by an assembly. It is admitted that the monarch will usually follow his private interest when it conflicts with that of the public, but so will an assembly. A monarch may have favourites, but so may every member of an assembly. Therefore, the total number of favourites is likely to be fewer under a monarchy. A monarch can hear advice from anybody secretly. An assembly can only hear advice from its own members, and that publicly. In an assembly, the chance absence of some may cause a different party to obtain the majority, and thus produce a change of policy. Moreover, if the assembly is divided against itself, the result may be civil war. For all these reasons, Hobbes concludes a monarchy is best. Throughout the Leviathan, Hobbes never considers the possible effect of periodical elections in curbing the tendency of assemblies to sacrifice the public interest to the private interest of their members. He seems, in fact, to be thinking not of democratically elected parliaments, but of bodies like the Grand Council in Venice or the House of Lords in England. He conceives democracy in the manner of antiquity, as involving the direct participation of every citizen in legislation and administration. At least, this seems to be his view. The part of the people in Hobbes's system ends completely with the first choice of a sovereign. The succession is to be determined by the sovereign, as was the practice in the Roman Empire when mutinies did not interfere. It is admitted that the sovereign will usually choose one of his own children, or a near relative if he has no children. But it is held that no law ought to prevent him from choosing otherwise. There is a chapter on the liberty of subjects which begins with an admirably precise definition. Liberty is the absence of external impediments to motion. In this sense, liberty is consistent with necessity. For instance, water necessarily flows downhill when there are no impediments to its motion, and when, therefore, according to the definition, it is free. A man is free to do what he wills, but necessitated to do what God wills. All our volitions have causes, and are in this sense necessary. As for the liberty of subjects, they are free where the laws do not interfere. This is no limitation of sovereignty, since the laws could interfere if the sovereign so decided. Subjects have no right as against the sovereign, except what the sovereign voluntarily concedes. When David caused Uriah to be killed, he did no injury to Uriah, because Uriah was his subject. But he did an injury to God, because he was God's subject and was disobeying God's law. The ancient authors, with their praises of liberty, have led men, according to Hobbes, to favour tumults and seditions. He maintains that, when they are rightly interpreted, the liberty they praised was that of sovereigns, that is, liberty from foreign domination. Internal resistance to sovereigns he condemns even when it might seem most justified. For example, he holds that St. Ambrose had no right to excommunicate the Emperor Theodosius after the massacre of Thessalonica. And he vehemently censures Pope Zachary for having helped to depose the last of the Merovingians in favour of Pepin. He admits, however, one limitation on the duty of submission to sovereigns. The right of self-preservation he regards as absolute, and subjects have the right of self-defence even against monarchs. This is logical, since he has made self-preservation the motive for instituting government. On this ground he holds, though with limitations, that a man has a right to refuse to fight when called upon by the government to do so. This is a right which no modern government concedes. A curious result of his egoistic ethic is that resistance to the sovereign is only justified in self-defense. Resistance in defense of another is always culpable. There is one other quite logical exception. A man has no duty to a sovereign who has not the power to protect him. This justified Hobbes's submission to Cromwell while Charles II was in exile. There must, of course, be no such bodies as political parties or what we should now call trade unions. All teachers are to be ministers of the sovereign and are to teach only what the sovereign thinks useful. The rights of property are only valid as against other subjects, not as against the sovereign. The sovereign has the right to regulate foreign trade. He is not subject to the civil law. His right to punish comes to him not from any concept of justice, but because he retains the liberty that all men had in the state of nature, when no man could be blamed for inflicting injury on another. There is an interesting list of the reasons, other than foreign conquest, for the dissolution of commonwealths. These are giving too little power to the sovereign, allowing private judgment in subjects, the theory that everything that is against conscience is sin, the belief in inspiration, the doctrine that the sovereign is subject to civil laws, the recognition of absolute private property, division of the sovereign power, imitation of the Greeks and Romans, separation of temporal and spiritual powers, refusing the power of taxation to the sovereign, the popularity of potent subjects, and the liberty of disputing with the sovereign. Of all these, there were abundant instances in the then-recent history of England and France. There should not, Hobbes thinks, be much difficulty in teaching people to believe in the rights of the sovereign, for have they not been taught to believe in Christianity, and even in transubstantiation, which is contrary to reason? There should be days set apart for learning the duty of submission. The instruction of the people depends upon right teaching in the universities, which must therefore be carefully supervised. There must be uniformity of worship, the religion being that ordained by the sovereign. Part two ends with the hope that some sovereign will read the book and make himself absolute, a less chimerical hope than Plato's, that some king would turn philosopher. Monarchs are assured that the book is easy reading and quite interesting. Part 3 of A Christian Commonwealth explains that there is no universal church because the church must depend upon the civil government. In each country, the king must be head of the church. The pope's overlordship and infallibility cannot be admitted. It argues, as might be expected, that a Christian who is a subject of a non-Christian sovereign should yield outwardly, for was not Naaman suffered to bow himself in the house of Rimmon? Part 4 of the Kingdom of Darkness is mainly concerned with criticism of the Church of Rome, which Hobbes hates because it puts the spiritual power above the temporal. The rest of this part is an attack on vain philosophy, by which Aristotle is usually meant. Let us now try to decide what we are to think of the Leviathan. The question is not easy because the good and the bad in it are so closely intermingled. In politics, there are two different questions, one as to the best form of the state, the other as to its powers. The best form of state, according to Hobbes, is monarchy, but this is not the important part of his doctrine. The important part is his contention that the powers of the state should be absolute. This doctrine, or something like it, had grown up in Western Europe during the Renaissance and the Reformation. First, the feudal nobility were cowed by Louis XI, Edward IV, Ferdinand and Isabella, and their successors. Then the Reformation in Protestant countries enabled the lay government to get the better of the church. Henry VIII wielded a power such as no earlier English king had enjoyed. But in France, the Reformation at first had an opposite effect. Between the Guise and the Huguenots, the kings were nearly powerless. Henry IV and Richelieu, not long before Hobbes wrote, had laid the foundations of the absolute monarchy which lasted in France till the Revolution. In Spain, Charles V had got the better of the Cortes, and
Philip... I realize that she's never sat for a portrait in...
In England, however, the Puritans had undone the work of Henry VIII. Their work suggested to Hobbes that anarchy must result from resistance to the sovereign. Every community is faced with two dangers, anarchy and despotism. The Puritans, especially the Independents, were most impressed by the danger of despotism. Hobbes, on the contrary, was obsessed by the fear of anarchy. The liberal philosophers who arose after the Restoration and acquired control after 1688 realized both dangers. They disliked both Strafford and the Anabaptists. This led Locke to the doctrine of division of powers and of checks and balances. In England, there was a real division of powers so long as the king had influence. Then Parliament became supreme, and ultimately the cabinet. In America, there are still checks and balances insofar as Congress and the Supreme Court can resist the administration, but the tendency is towards a constant increase in the powers of the administration. In Germany, Italy, Russia, and Japan, the government has even more power than Hobbes thought desirable. On the whole, therefore, as regards the powers of the state, the world has gone as Hobbes wished, after a long liberal period, during which, at least apparently, it was moving in the opposite direction. Whatever may be the outcome of the present war, it seems evident that the functions of the state must continue to increase, and that resistance to it must grow more and more difficult. The reason that Hobbes gives for supporting the state, namely that it is the only alternative to anarchy, is in the main a valid one. A state may, however, be so bad that temporary anarchy seems preferable to its continuance, as in France in 1789 and in Russia in 1917. Moreover, the tendency of every government towards tyranny cannot be kept in check unless governments have some fear of rebellion. Governments would be worse than they are if Hobbes's submissive attitude were universally adopted by subjects. This is true in the political sphere, where governments will try, if they can, to make themselves personally irremovable. It is true in the economic sphere, where they will try to enrich themselves and their friends at the public expense. It is true in the intellectual sphere, where they will suppress every new discovery or doctrine that seems to menace their power. These are reasons for not thinking only of the risk of anarchy, but also of the danger of injustice and ossification that is bound up with omnipotence in government. The merits of Hobbes appear most clearly when he is contrasted with earlier political theorists. He is completely free from superstition. He does not argue from what happened to Adam and Eve at the time of the fall. He is clear and logical. His ethics, right or wrong, is completely intelligible and does not involve the use of any dubious concepts. Apart from Machiavelli, who is much more limited, he is the first really modern writer on political theory. Where he is wrong from oversimplification, not because the basis of his thought is unreal and fantastic. For this reason, he is still worth refuting. Without criticizing Hobbes's metaphysics or ethics, there are two points to make against him. The first is that he always considers the national interest as a whole, and assumes tacitly that the major interests of all citizens are the same. He does not realize the importance of the clash between different classes, which Marx makes the chief cause of social change. This is connected with the assumption that the interests of a monarch are roughly identical with those of his subjects. In time of war, there is a unification of interests, especially if the war is fierce. But in time of peace, the clash may be very great between the interests of one class and those of another. It is not by any means always true that, in such a situation, the best way to avert anarchy is to preach the absolute power of the sovereign. Some concession in the way of sharing power may be the only way to prevent civil war. This should have been obvious to Hobbes from the recent history of England. Another point in which Hobbes's doctrine is unduly limited is in regard to the relations between different states. There is not a word in Leviathan to suggest any relation between them except war and conquest, with occasional interludes. This follows, on his principles, from the absence of an international government, for the relations of states are still in a state of nature, which is that of a war of all against all. So long as there is international anarchy, it is by no means clear that increase of efficiency in the separate states is in the interest of mankind, since it increases the ferocity and destructiveness of war. Every argument that he adduces in favor of government, in so far as it is valid at all, is valid in favor of international government. So long as national states exist and fight each other, only inefficiency can preserve the human race. To improve the fighting quality of separate states without having any means of preventing war is the road to universal destruction. Chapter 9. Descartes. René Descartes, 1596 to 1650, is usually considered the founder of modern philosophy, and I think rightly. He is the first man of high philosophic capacity whose outlook is profoundly affected by the new physics and astronomy. While it is true that he retains much of scholasticism, he does not accept foundations laid by predecessors, but endeavours to construct a complete philosophic edifice de novo. This had not happened since Aristotle, and is a sign of the new self-confidence that resulted from the progress of science. There is a freshness about his work that is not to be found in any eminent previous philosopher since Plato. All the intermediate philosophers were teachers, with the professional superiority belonging to that avocation. Descartes writes not as a teacher, but as a discoverer and explorer, anxious to communicate what he has found. His style is easy and unpedantic, addressed to intelligent men of the world rather than to pupils. It is, moreover, an extraordinarily elegant style. It is very fortunate for modern philosophy that the pioneer had such admirable literary sense. His successors, both on the continent and in England, until Kant, retain his unprofessional character, and several of them retain something of his stylistic merit. Descartes' father was a councillor of the Parliament of Brittany, and possessed a moderate amount of landed property. When Descartes inherited at his father's death, he sold his estates and invested the money, obtaining an income of 6,000 or 7,000 francs a year. He was educated from 1604 to 1612 at the Jesuit College of La Flèche, which seems to have given him a much better grounding in modern mathematics than he could have got at most universities at that time. In 1612 he went to Paris, where he found social life boring, and retired to a secluded retreat in the Faubourg Saint-Germain, in which he worked at geometry. Friends nosed him out, however, so, to secure more complete quiet, he enlisted in the Dutch army, 1617. As Holland was at peace at the time, he seems to have enjoyed 2 years of undisturbed meditation. However, the coming of the Thirty Years' War led him to enlist in the Bavarian army, 1619. It was in Bavaria, during the winter 1619-20, that he had the experience he describes in the Discours de la Méthode. The weather being cold, he got into a stove in the morning and stayed there all day meditating. Footnote: Descartes says it was a stove, poêle, but most commentators think this impossible. Those who know old-fashioned Bavarian houses, however, assure me that it is entirely credible. End of footnote. By his own account, his philosophy was half-finished when he came out. But this need not be accepted too literally. Socrates used to meditate all day in the snow, but Descartes' mind only worked when he was warm. In 1621 he gave up fighting. After a visit to Italy, he settled in Paris in 1625. But again, friends would call on him before he was up. He seldom got up before midday. So in 1628 he joined the army which was besieging La Rochelle, the Huguenot stronghold. When this episode was finished, he decided to live in Holland, probably to escape the risk of persecution. He was a timid man, a practicing Catholic, but he shared Galileo's heresies. Some think that he heard of the first secret condemnation of Galileo, which had taken place in 1616. However that may be, he decided not to publish a great book, Le Monde, upon which he had been engaged. His reason was that it maintained two heretical doctrines, the Earth's rotation and the infinity of the universe. This book was never published in its entirety, but fragments of it were published after his death. He lived in Holland for 20 years, 1629-49, except for a few brief visits to France and one to England, all on business. It is impossible to exaggerate the importance of Holland in the 17th century, as the one country where there was freedom of speculation. Hobbes had to have his books printed there. Locke took refuge there during the 5 worst years of reaction in England before 1688. Bayle, of the Dictionary, found it necessary to live there, and Spinoza would hardly have been allowed to do his work in any other country. I said that Descartes was a timid man, but perhaps it would be kinder to say that he wished to be left in peace, so as to do his work undisturbed. He always courted ecclesiastics, especially Jesuits, not only while he was in their power, but after his emigration to Holland. His psychology is obscure, but I incline to think that he was a sincere Catholic, and wished to persuade the Church, in its own interests as well as in his, to be less hostile to modern science than it showed itself in the case of Galileo. There are those who think that his orthodoxy was merely politic, but though this is a possible view, I do not think it is the most probable. Even in Holland, he was subject to vexatious attacks, not by the Roman Church, but by Protestant bigots. It was said that his views led to atheism, and he would have been prosecuted but for the intervention of the French ambassador and the Prince of Orange. This attack having failed, another less direct was made a few years later by the authorities of the University of Leiden, which forbade all mention of him, whether favourable or unfavourable. Again, the Prince of Orange intervened and told the university not to be silly. This illustrates the gain to Protestant countries from the subordination of the church to the state and from the comparative weakness of churches that were not international. Unfortunately, through Chanu, the French ambassador at Stockholm, Descartes got into correspondence with Queen Christina of Sweden, a passionate and learned lady who thought that, as a sovereign, she had a right to waste the time of great men. He sent her a treatise on love, a subject which, until then, he had somewhat neglected. He also sent her a work on the passions of the soul, which he had originally composed for Princess Elizabeth, daughter of the Elector Palatine. These writings led her to request his presence at her court. He at last agreed, and she sent a warship to fetch him, September 1649. It turned out that she wanted daily lessons from him, but could not spare the time except at 5 in the morning. This unaccustomed early rising in the cold of a Scandinavian winter was not the best thing for a delicate man. Moreover, Chanu became dangerously ill, and Descartes looked after him. The ambassador recovered, but Descartes fell ill and died in February 1650. Descartes never married, but he had a natural daughter who died at the age of 5. This was, he said, the greatest sorrow of his life. He always was well-dressed and wore a sword. He was not industrious. He worked short hours and read little. When he went to Holland, he took few books with him, but among them were the Bible and Thomas Aquinas. His work seems to have been done with great concentration during short periods, but perhaps to keep up the appearance of a gentlemanly amateur, he may have pretended to work less than in fact he did, for otherwise his achievements seem scarcely credible. Descartes was a philosopher, a mathematician, and a man of science. In philosophy and mathematics, his work was of supreme importance. In science, though creditable, it was not so good as that of some of his contemporaries. His great contribution to geometry was the invention of coordinate geometry, though not quite in its final form. He used the analytic method, which supposes a problem solved and examines the consequences of the supposition, and he applied algebra to geometry. In both of these, he had had predecessors, as regards the former, even among the ancients. What was original in him was the use of coordinates, that is, the determination of the position of a point in a plane by its distance from two fixed lines. He did not himself discover all the power of this method, but he did enough to make further progress easy. This was by no means his sole contribution to mathematics, but it was his most important. The book in which he set forth most of his scientific theories was Principia Philosophiae, published in 1644. There were, however, some other books of importance. Essai Philosophique, 1637, deals with optics as well as geometry, and one of his books is called De la Formation du Foetus. He welcomed Harvey's discovery of the circulation of the blood, and was always hoping, though in vain, to make some discovery of importance in medicine. He regarded the bodies of men and animals as machines. Animals he regarded as automata, governed entirely by the laws of physics, and devoid of feeling or consciousness. Men are different. They have a soul, which resides in the pineal gland. There the soul comes in contact with the vital spirits, and through this contact there is interaction between soul and body. The total quantity of motion in the universe is constant, and therefore the soul cannot affect it. But it can alter the direction of motion of the animal spirits, and hence indirectly of other parts of the body. This part of his theory was abandoned by his school, first by his Dutch disciple, Gerlinks, and later by Malebranche and Spinoza. The physicists discovered the conservation of momentum, according to which the total quantity of motion in the world in any given direction is constant. This showed that the sort of action of mind on matter that Descartes imagined is impossible, assuming, as was very generally assumed in the Cartesian school, that all physical action is of the nature of impact,
dynamical laws suffice to determine the motions of matter, and there is no room for any influence of mind. But this raises a difficulty. My arm moves when I will that it shall move, but my will is a mental phenomenon, and the motion of my arm a physical phenomenon. Why then, if mind and matter cannot interact, does my body behave as if my mind controlled it? To this, Görlings invented an answer, known as the theory of the two clocks. Suppose you have two clocks which both keep perfect time. Whenever one points to the hour, the other will strike, so that if you saw one and heard the other, you would think the one caused the other to strike. So it is with mind and body. Each is wound up by God to keep time with the other, so that on occasion of my volition, purely physical laws cause my arm to move, although my will has not really acted on my body. There were, of course, difficulties in this theory. In the first place, it was very odd. In the second place, since the physical series was rigidly determined by natural laws, the mental series, which ran parallel to it, must be equally deterministic. If the theory was valid, there should be a sort of possible dictionary in which each cerebral occurrence would be translated into the corresponding mental occurrence. An ideal calculator could calculate the cerebral occurrence by the laws of dynamics and infer the concomitant mental occurrence by means of the dictionary. Even without the dictionary, the calculator could infer any words and actions, since these are bodily movements. This view would be difficult to reconcile with Christian ethics and the punishment of sin. These consequences, however, were not at once apparent. The theory appeared to have two merits. The first was that it made the soul, in a sense, wholly independent of the body, since it was never acted on by the body. The second was that it allowed the general principle, one substance cannot act on another. There were two substances, mind and matter, and they were so dissimilar that an interaction seemed inconceivable. Görlings's theory explained the appearance of interaction while denying its reality. In mechanics, Descartes accepts the first law of motion, according to which a body left to itself will move with constant velocity in a straight line. But there is no action at a distance, as later in Newton's theory of gravitation. There is no such thing as a vacuum, and there are no atoms. Yet all interaction is of the nature of impact. If we knew enough, we should be able to reduce chemistry and biology to mechanics. The process by which a seed develops into an animal or a plant is purely mechanical. There is no need of Aristotle's three souls. Only one of them, the rational soul, exists, and that only in man. With due caution to avoid theological censure, Descartes develops a cosmogony not unlike those of some pre-Platonic philosophers. We know, he says, that the world was created as in Genesis, but it is interesting to see how it might have grown naturally. He works out a theory of the formation of vortices. Round the sun, there is an immense vortex in the plenum which carries the planets round with it. The theory is ingenious, but cannot explain why planetary orbits are elliptical, not circular. It was generally accepted in France, where it was only gradually ousted by the Newtonian theory. Coates, the editor of the first English edition of Newton's Principia, argues eloquently that the vortex theory leads to atheism, while Newton's requires God to set the planets in motion in a direction not towards the sun. On this ground, he thinks, Newton is to be preferred. I come now to Descartes' two most important books, so far as pure philosophy is concerned. These are the Discourse on Method, 1637, and the Meditations, 1642. They largely overlap, and it is not necessary to keep them apart. In these books, Descartes begins by explaining the method of Cartesian doubt, as it has come to be called. In order to have a firm basis for his philosophy, he resolves to make himself doubt everything that he can manage to doubt. As he foresees that the process may take some time, he resolves, in the meanwhile, to regulate his conduct by commonly received rules. This will leave his mind unhampered by the possible consequences of his doubts in relation to practice. He begins with skepticism in regard to the senses. Can I doubt, he says, that I am sitting here by the fire in a dressing gown? Yes, for sometimes I have dreamt that I was here when in fact I was naked in bed. Pajamas and even nightshirts had not yet been invented. Moreover, madmen sometimes have hallucinations, so it is possible that I may be in like case. Dreams, however, like painters, present us with copies of real things, at least as regards their elements. You may dream of a winged horse, but only because you have seen horses and wings. Therefore, corporeal nature in general, involving such matters as extension, magnitude, and number, is less easy to question than beliefs about particular things. Arithmetic and geometry, which are not concerned with particular things, are therefore more certain than physics and astronomy. They are true even of dream objects, which do not differ from real ones as regards number and extension. Even in regard to arithmetic and geometry, however, doubt is possible. It may be that God causes me to make mistakes whenever I try to count the sides of a square or add 2 to 3. Perhaps it is wrong, even in imagination, to attribute such unkindness to God. But there might be an evil demon, no less cunning and deceitful than powerful, employing all his industry in misleading me. If there be such a demon, it may be that all the things I see are only illusions of which he makes use as traps for my credulity. There remains, however, something that I cannot doubt. No demon, however cunning, could deceive me if I did not exist. I may have no body, this might be an illusion, but thought is different. While I wanted to think everything false, it must necessarily be that I who thought was something, and remarking that this truth I think, therefore I am, was so solid and so certain that all the most extravagant suppositions of the skeptics were incapable of upsetting it, I judged that I could receive it without scruple as the first principle of the philosophy that I sought. Footnote. The above argument, I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum, is known as Descartes' cogito, and the process by which it is reached is called Cartesian doubt. End of footnote. This passage is the kernel of Descartes' theory of knowledge, and contains what is most important in his philosophy. Most philosophers since Descartes have attached importance to the theory of knowledge, and their doing so is largely due to him. I think, therefore I am, makes mind more certain than matter, and my mind, for me, more certain than the minds of others.